Theodore saw his son off to Cambridge, off to become a Harvard man, from the little station stop at Syosset, Long Island, on September 27, 1876. At 17, the boy was as tall as he would grow, 5 feet 8 inches, and he weighed at most 125 pounds. His voice was thin and piping, almost comical. The blue-gray eyes squinted and blinked behind thick spectacles, which, when he laughed or bobbed his head about, kept sliding down his nose. The sound of his laugh was described by his mother as an ungreased squeak. In conversation, he spewed words with a force that often startled people not accustomed to him, and this, with his upper-class New York accent, would be enough to set him off as something out of the ordinary at Harvard, even at Harvard, from the time he arrived. To many, it seemed he had a speech impediment, and possibly the problem may have been associated with his asthmatic condition, physiologically, that is. But it appears also to have been such an integral part of his makeup, so established a trait that those within the home circle took no notice of it. They were as oblivious to this, apparently, as they had been earlier to his myopia. If he talked funny, they never thought so. At Harvard, classmates soon learned to goad him into an argument for the sheer fun of hearing him. His large, extremely white teeth appeared to chop sentences to pieces. Words tumbled over one another. At times, he could hardly get them out at all, remembered a friend, and then he would rush on, as skaters redouble their pace over thin ice. The teeth and glasses were the outstanding features, though he preferred his ears, which were unusually small and close to his head. "I don't think my features separately are very good with the exception of my ears," he would one day tell a sculptor. "I like my ears, they are good. I always notice the ears of everyone." His hands and feet, too, were unusually small. His feet actually dainty, a mere size 5 or 6. The slippers he took with him to Harvard were his mother's, and they fit perfectly. The great reformation of physique to which he had devoted so many hours would have been judged a flat failure by anybody unfamiliar with the circumstances. A classmate named Richard Welling, seeing him for the first time during a workout at Harvard gym, could hardly believe his eyes. He confronted, Welling said, "a youth in the kindergarten stage of physical development, who was standing between two upright poles, gripping them with both hands and swaying forward and back, rising nicely on tiptoe at each forward thrust." What a humble-minded chap this must be, Welling thought, to be willing to give such a ladylike exhibition in a public space. In a sporting calendar that he had kept at Oyster Bay the summer of 1875, it is recorded that he could do the 100-yard dash in 12.25 seconds, broad jump 13 feet, and clear the bar in the pole vault at 5 feet 8.5 inches. In all, nothing very special for a boy of his age, but apparently better than his cousins could do, and attainments of much pride to him. His health, though unquestionably improved over what it had been earlier, was still a worry and a burden. He was no more a model of good health than he was a strapping physical specimen. His health, like his physique, was impressive only in contrast to what it had been. Some of his sieges of colic, his headaches, the vomiting and diarrhea, his dreaded cholera morbus, appear to have been quite serious. In March, preparing for the Harvard examinations, he worried that he lost so much time in my studies through sickness. And after he had been accepted to Harvard, it was decided that for reasons of health he could not possibly live among other students in one of the dormitories. He was to have private rooms of his own and no roommate. Bammy, the Major Generalis, as Ellie called her, was sent on in advance to Cambridge that summer to find suitable quarters off campus. She chose his furniture, had the rooms painted, papered, saw that there was coal for the fireplace.